Gentlemen. Chief Rabbi, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the executive and the members, I'm delighted to welcome you to the opening evening of Jewish Book Week 1987. Now, those of you who know me will know that I was never brilliant at maths, and it never struck me till a short time ago that if the Book Council was founded in 1947, this is its 40th anniversary year. So this is a very special book week, and to match it, we have a very special guest, Dr. Norman Lamb, President of Yeshiva University, who has come to England just for this lecture, the George Weber Memorial Lecture. And you have done us great honor, Dr. Lamb, and we warmly welcome you and your wife, and I look forward to introducing you very shortly. And I think that I can say that this magnificent audience tonight is going to take advantage of the opportunity of hearing you. First, let me bring you up to date briefly on the activities of the Book Council, as is the tradition. When it began just after the war, it had a simple formula: lectures and books for sale. And 40 years on, the formula is exactly the same, but Book Week has changed. And you know how it's changed? It's no longer a minority event, just a few people. Up and down the country, organizations and communities are running their own events. On Wednesday, there's one in Cambridge, a two-day event starting. In the spring, Chigwell, Stanmore and Liverpool are all organising their own events as part of Book Week. Other organisations and communities do it anyway. It is a formula that's the most attractive one. So more books are exhibited and sold, and here tonight we have a really comprehensive display, perhaps the biggest that we've ever had. And there's a new dimension this year, actually, a most exciting one. For the first time, books in Hebrew are going to be available on a regular basis. They're going to be sold all year round by the Jewish Memorial Council bookshop. Every year people say to me, how can you have a book event and no books in Hebrew? Well now, on the initiative of Yehoshua Kuperav, who's an Israeli book distributor living in London, this gap is being filled. And the Book Council is delighted to be associated with this exciting venture. Another project I'd like to mention is a lecture series on the Jewish East End, which is going to be held at the Museum of London as part of the Jewish East End celebration. If you haven't heard about this celebration, you soon will. It is really exciting. It's going to take place from May until July. So that's the basic activity of the Book Council at the moment, and I would like to say tonight, as it's the only opportunity, I would like to say thank you to all the people and organisations who work together to create this event, because an enormous amount of work goes into it. First of all, the members of the executive, the honorary officers and the executive, each of whom has their own part to play, and for whom I speak tonight. Then I would like to thank the affiliated organisations. They give us financial support, but they give us what is equally important, unswerving loyalty and support. The names of all the organisations actively involved in the work of the Book Council, they're all printed in the leaflet. And I would like to thank all the honorary officers and members of those organisations who are here tonight, because we really appreciate your continued loyalty. It means a great deal, and we do not take it for granted. I must mention also the United Synagogue, with great thanks, under whose auspices we meet at the Adolf Tuck Hall. The Hillel Foundation, for their generosity, and the Board of Deputies, who have organised the young men and women of the Community Security Organisation to take care of the necessary security precautions for this event. And last, a big thank you to the Jewish Memorial Council Bookshop, to Rosalie Lehrer and her team who work before, during and after. It's a mammoth task handling these hundreds and hundreds of titles of books, and they do it supremely well, and we are most grateful. And now I'm delighted to introduce our distinguished guest speaker, Dr. Norman Lamb. Dr. Lamb gained degrees and qualified in three very separate spheres. He took his first degree in chemistry, and at the same time he continued his Jewish studies and became a rabbi. He then went on to get a doctorate in Jewish philosophy. He chose the rabbinate as a career and served as rabbi in New York and Massachusetts before his appointment at the Jewish Center in Manhattan. But at the same time, he developed an academic career, joining the faculty of his old university, Yeshiva University, to teach philosophy. And in 1966, he was appointed professor of Jewish philosophy. He was already gaining a name for his writings on the interpretation of Jewish law and philosophy. Now, very often, scholars write on subjects that are appreciated and understood by other scholars, on subjects that are remote from day-to-day life and current issues. Dr. Lamb has applied his considerable learning to just these issues, recognizing the dilemmas in which traditional Jews find themselves today. Faith and Doubt, which is now in its second edition, covers just these issues. He's also addressed himself to the great problem of religious polarization within the community. And he discussed this in an article published last year in the Jewish Chronicle, Divided We Stand. In addition, he is editor of the prestigious library of Jewish Law and Ethics, which is concerned with current halakhic and ethical problems. And he's not only an outstanding scholar, but an outstanding administrator, because as president of Yeshiva University, which he became 10 years ago, he has put it on a secure financial footing, which it wasn't before he came, and has greatly strengthened its administrative structure. And with all this, he continues to write and to lecture, and tonight we have a rare opportunity to hear him. Now, Book Week is always a bittersweet time for me and my family. I find it incredibly appropriate, Dr. Lamb, that you should be giving this lecture in memory of George Weber, because he too was a man of diverse interests in law and Hebrew literature and Jewish thought. And I must say that you would have been a man after his own heart. In the 40th anniversary year of the Book Council, which he founded and loved so much, you have done us great honour, the family and the Book Council, to have agreed to come to give this lecture. And I should like to thank you. And I now have much pleasure in asking you to speak.
Chief Rabbi, the last, Mrs. Lehrer, Mrs. Weber, ladies and gentlemen, I'm very grateful to you, Mrs. Lehrer, both for your organizational talents and your very gracious hospitality to my wife and to me, and above all, for the wonderful things you said about me. I really could sit and listen to them for hours. Not only because of the normal penchant for approbation and compliments, but I confess that I have a special need for them. You see, I'm the president of a very complicated and complex institution, and no one ever told me before I was elected that the major task I would have would be to be the butt of criticism no matter what I did or did not do. You must have heard the story of the fellow who had to get up in the morning and didn't want to, and his mother kept on pushing him and shoving him and said, "You've got to get up." And he said, "I don't want to get up." And he said, "But you've got to go to school." He said, "But I don't want to go to school because the teachers hate me and the students hate me. Why should I go to school?" And she said, "Because you're the headmaster. That's why you have to go to school." Well, when you're the president of a large university and the faculties hate you and the students hate you and the government hates you and the contributors hate you and who else, then when you come here to this country and you hear such wonderful things, such extravagant compliments, it's balm for my spirit. I'm delighted that the Chief Rabbi has honored me with his presence. I've been a friend of Sir Emmanuel and his lady for close to 30 years now. And friendship has remained firm throughout all this time, from Fifth Avenue to Hamilton Terrace. And I would like to take this opportunity to offer my mazel tov to Sir Emmanuel on his 20th anniversary. 20 very eventful, interesting, exciting, as we Americans say, and brilliantly performed service during these 20 years. He has, in a very wise way, very wisely been the steward of the Jewish tradition in this community in a time of great transition and great vicissitudes. So my compliments to you, Sir Emmanuel, and my good wishes ad meo v'yesod shana. I am honored, Mrs. Lehrer, to have been invited to deliver this lecture in the memory of a great Jewish gentleman, Dr. George Weber, all of us shalom, made possible by his loving and loyal family. It's a credit to this historic Jewish community that Jewish literature, writing, learning, thought is celebrated at such a celebration. I think it appropriate, too, because Yeshiva University, which this year celebrates its centennial, its 100th birthday, stands for Torah Umada, for the synthesis of Jewish learning of Torah with secular learning. And it is therefore doubly significant for me to deliver a lecture in honor of a man who represented a lay combination of worldliness and the Jewish commitment to learning. The title I gave Mrs. Lehrer is really not a title, but I'm going to stick to it, which is not very difficult, the emerging Jewish world. The most salient characteristic of modernity is the fragmentation of Jewish life and community. Both in Israel and the diaspora, this fragmentation has now developed into polarization, a phenomenon most likely to accelerate as we emerge into the 21st century. And the great question is, what does this portend for our future? How will it affect the viability of our people as an Am Echad, as one nation? Will our grandchildren recognize their common patrimony with each other, with other Jews? Will they see in other Jews brothers and sisters? A key word bandied about in recent years as an antidote to our chronic worry over divisiveness and disunity is pluralism, an affirmation of the value and worthiness of multiplicity of views and commitments and values, of the heterogeneity of all kinds of opinions and ideas. The question I ask is, Is pluralism really an alternative to rampant extremism? Or is it an illusion conjured up by those who want to put a good face on an ugly situation? Is it the beginning of a new and valuable insight on how to live together? Or is it just the newest member of a lexicon of Jewish trendiness? And I'm going to divide my talk into three parts, three unequal parts. I shall consider three concentric circles when we speak of pluralism. Number one, halachic pluralism, pluralism within the halacha. Number two, religious pluralism of various religious commitments. And number three, communal Jewish pluralism in its largest context. I shall not discuss halachic pluralism in any depth. It may be too technical and certainly overly theoretical. But just to give you a clue to my thinking, my answer is yes. I believe that the halacha, Jewish law, is pluralistic. If we accept halacha as binding, that does not mean that every question can have but one answer and one answer only. It is possible to have a variety of solutions to many halachic problems. And it is this framework alone, to my mind, which can contain in one community of commitment such diverse groups as Hasidim and Misnagdim, as Mekilim and Machmirim, those who take a more lenient and those who take a more stringent view, as Charedim and Datiyim, as they're known in Israel, the more, looking for a word that's appropriate, the more intensely Orthodox and the more modern Orthodox. So I ask your indulgence if I do not elaborate on this particular theoretical concern. I have written upon it and hope to continue to do so. And while the matter of halachic pluralism is relevant to religious and communal pluralism, the other two I shall be discussing, it is not crucial. Hence, I shall now turn to the second topic. I'm sorry that the others won't go as quickly. Religious pluralism. This is the question of whether halachic and non-halachic interpretations of Judaism, or if you will, Orthodox and non-Orthodox, can live in mutual respect, recognition, and in mutual legitimation. As you heard from Mrs. Lara, I wrote about this in a recent article in the Jewish Chronicle. If I repeat it now, friends, it is done in full confidence that most people didn't read it, and that those who did read it have by now thankfully forgotten it. I shall only summarize, and here too I shall be reasonably brief. This form of pluralism was probably precipitated by that painful "who is a Jew" issue in Israel and elsewhere, and has been offered as a response to the escalating extremism in our communities, and has itself become the object of extremism and polarization. But let me first present my prejudices, so you know where I am coming from, as we say. I am a committed Orthodox Jew who abhors extremism and espouses moderation as a matter of conviction and not merely as concession, as an ideal and desideratum, not as a compromise and not as a matter of prudence. And yet, I ask you to bear in mind these three or several caveats. Let us not use the word extremist too lightly. It can be used as an epithet as well as a good description. One man's reasonableness is another man's extremism. Is Lubavitch moderate or extreme? Is Chief Rabbi Jacobowitz moderate or extreme? Am I moderate or extreme? Well, really, it depends upon your vantage point. Hence, while there certainly are extremists, we've got to be cautious and not use the term recklessly. Second, a word or two in favor of extremism. Extremism, as we understand the term, or extremists, have a gift of both passion and logic. They have the ability to take an idea and take it to its logical conclusion. It was a great American educator, the president of Columbia University, Nicholas Murray Butler, who once said that the extremes are logical but absurd. And it's true. Also, extremists by definition offer rather simple answers to complicated problems, and they prefer not to see nuances and subtleties and shades, or if they see them, they tend to dismiss them. And therefore, simple solutions generate far more emotion and far more passion than the recognition of the complexity of life and life situations. Now, I shall use the word moderation not as an arithmetic mean. I am not a moderate. If by moderation you mean that I am someplace halfway between monotheism and idolatry, or between integrity and crookedness, or between compassion and cruelty. Unfortunately, moderation, like tolerance, is the easy prize of those who lack conviction and don't really care too much. Rather, for me, what distinguishes moderation from extremism, for our purposes, I'm not giving a universal definition, is the ability to have a strong opinion and a powerful commitment, and yet have respect for your opponent, tolerance, and a measure of openness. There is no question that and I'm going to make one more preparatory statement. I'm not saying this humorously. I am speaking about the United States. No reference whatsoever to these glorious shores. If it does somehow strike you as having reference, it probably is a mistake. But there's no question that interreligious polemics in the United States and in Israel have not been moderate. You already know from the press, all the Jewish press, and perhaps the secular press as well, about Orthodox extremism. Indeed, we Orthodox Jews have not been lacking in the use of invective and empurpled rhetoric. You know the story of the great German Jewish researcher who spent a lifetime investigating Jewish humor, and after 40 years of work, he came to the conclusion that he had found only one joke, only one witticism in all the Talmud, and that was the Talmudic statement that Talmidei Chachamim Marbim Shalom Ba'olam, scholars increase peace in the world. We Orthodox Jews, and I hate to borrow from communists, we could use some glasnost, some openness. But you should also know that extremism is not confined to one camp, that there is an equal and opposite reaction in anti-Orthodoxy. And I say with a great deal of pain, after, 35, 36 years in public life in America, never have I felt such waves of animosity directed against Orthodox Jews of any stripe as I now feel in the councils of UJA or Federation throughout American Jewish community. It is palpable and scary, frightening. There are cases of extremism where certain groups have effectively blackmailed members of Knesset or others who disagree with them, blackmailed, blackballed, who have not permitted them to come to their synagogue. There are those who are attempting to withhold funds from any Orthodox institutions. One particular philanthropist who obviously shall go nameless recently told a very worthy Jewish institution, not mine, that he will be glad to give them funds if they will teach equally about all interpretations of Judaism. Little children of 5 or 6 years old. All of us can use some moderation, and all of us could use some derech eretz. It's in response to these escalating religious polemics in Israel and the United States that we have been preferred the ideal of pluralism. What does that mean? That instead of clashing on various issues and demanding that one side or the other prevail, let us agree to disagree agreeably. Let us live and let live. And let us agree that Judaism admits of a multiplicity, a plurality of interpretations and practices. And therefore, although I may not accept another opinion, each of them is legitimate. And it is quite all right for every person to make a choice, not only a democratic choice as a free citizen of a free country, but morally, religiously, all are equally legitimate. Now, I confess to being confused by all this apparently attractive talk about religious pluralism. My sense of caution is enhanced and shocked by the sudden popularity of the term pluralism, because it has become a symbol. And whenever an idea becomes a symbol, it becomes so enmeshed in emotions, so entangled in mass psychology, that it is exceedingly difficult to treat it critically. Ideas become impervious to analysis when, like pluralism, they are turned into, well, incantations and hallowed formulae. Sacred cows, like golden calves, inevitably lead one astray. The way pluralism has been used in recent months and years makes it sound suspiciously like relativism, reducing all differences in principle ultimately to questions of taste. Relativism is the proposition that because there are so many kinds of things or points of view, therefore each has an equal right to be heard in a democratic society, and therefore they are all necessarily equally valid. Well, if pluralism is just the newest name for that kind of discredited ethical or religious relativism, I don't think it's deserving of our attention. My concept of pluralism in the Jewish religious community can best be summed up by a famous dictum, famous saying in the Jewish tradition. And that is that Shiv'im Padim LaTorah, there are 70 faces or facets to Torah. No one is more significant or legitimate than the other 69. Judaism is not monolithic. However, there are only 70. 70 is not a necessary number. There is a limited number of options or interpretations, not an infinite number of such faces or facets. A pluralism that accepts everything as co-legitimate is not pluralism, but the kind of relativism that leads ultimately to spiritual nihilism, to nothingness. Because if everything is kosher, then nothing is kosher. If Torah has an infinite number of faces, it is faceless and without value or significance. Learned Jews are fully aware of the Talmud's comments on the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai that Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim, that both these and these are the words of the living God. Unfortunately, this profound and beautiful statement has been abused and turned into a slogan by ignoring the fact that the controversialists, the Shammaites and the Hillelites, oh, I thought it was a kind of applause you have here, were at one in their commitment to the halakha and its divine origin, and disagreed only on its interpretation, on the halakhic interpretation, with regard to very specific matters. Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim implies a pluralism within the halakhic context. Only what we have called halakhic pluralism, not religious pluralism. You simply cannot stretch it to cover all interpretations of Judaism as co-legitimate. Now, because Orthodox rabbis consider the other movements, those movements not bound by the traditional halakha, as heterodox, as heretical, many American rabbis refuse to accord non-Orthodox rabbis in America any credibility at all as leaders of Jewish religious communities. They simply deny their existence. And when I speak to my fellow American rabbis, I tell them that I consider this an error. Facts cannot be wished away by theories, no matter how cherished. And the facts are that such non-Orthodox communities are vital, they're often dynamic, they are clearly a part of Klal Yisrael, and they consider their rabbis as their leaders. From a functional point of view, therefore, non-Orthodox rabbis are valid leaders of Jewish religious communities, and it is self-defeating not to acknowledge this openly and to draw the necessary consequences, such as harmoniously working together, all of us, towards those Jewish communal and global goals that we share and that unite us inextricably and indissolubly. But what I have called functional validity is not identical with Jewish legitimacy, and allow me to explain the difference between these terms. The word validity derives from the Latin validus, which means strong. It is a factual, descriptive term. Legitimacy derives from the Latin lex, or law. It is a normative and evaluative term. Validity describes the fact of one's religious existence, not its substance. But it is content which, to my eyes, determines what we are terming legitimacy. Content, which means within the law, not within the law. Here I have no choice but to judge such legitimacy by my own understanding of what constitutes Judaism and what does not. The criterion of such legitimacy is the Jewish lex, or the halakha, not a specific interpretation of an individual halakha, not even a general tendency to be lenient or not to be lenient, but the fundamental acceptance of its authority, of Torah Min HaShemayim and Torah Min Sinai, of halakha as transcendentally obligatory on Jews, as a holy and normative halakha or halicha, the way for Jews, as decisive law, not just something to consult in the process of developing polity. Hence, I consider myself a brother to all Jews in love and in respect, and together with them, I for one seek the unity of our people. But I cannot, in the name of such unity, assent to a legitimation of what every fiber of my being tells me is in violation of the most sacred precepts of our Torah tradition. You see, at bottom, any vision of the truth excludes certain competing visions. We can't be all things to all people. We can't accept all things as co-equal. And so it is with the Torah commitment. Under no circumstances can an Orthodox Jew, for instance, consider as Jewishly authentic a view of Judaism that excludes faith in God, such as we have in America, humanistic Judaism, or one that condones marriage of Jew with non-Jew, unconverted by anyone's standards, or one that rejects the halachic strictures of Shabbat observance or the laws of divorce or the institutions of kashrut. Yet all of these deviations, including co-officiating with Christian clergy at intermarriage, is practiced by some Reform rabbis, we call them liberal in America, and condoned by very many of them. To ask that in the name of pluralism Orthodox Jews accept such interpretations as Jewishly legitimate is to ask that we stop being Orthodox. Well, if that is what religious pluralism and mutual legitimation mean, the price is too high. Hence, while in the matter of halachic pluralism I accept completely that the halacha is pluralistic, in the question of religious pluralism, I accept only mutual validation, not mutual legitimation. We can and must work together, but we cannot accept anti-halachic notions as having Jewish legitimacy. I believe that the distinction is both genuine and workable. Given this principle, this point of view, what of the future? Will it work? Are we going to be one people? Well, you know the definition of the Jewish telegram? The text of the Jewish telegram is, "Start worrying now," letter follows. For the short haul, it won't be as bad. Intermediate, it's going to get worse. But I remain optimistic about the long haul. And my optimism is simply, well, intuitive, it's instinctual. Despite Haredi militantism, despite the apparently insoluble who is a Jew problem that crops up in Israel constantly, despite what has happened in America with the conservative movement, now having women rabbis and now women cantors, despite the shocking vote of the Reform group in favor of patrilineal descent, we can all work for those items on the religious agenda which are significant and important to all of us mutually. But I am confident that ultimately, and this is simply an expression of my faith, we will be united by a common return to God and Torah. Now let me turn from halakhic and religious pluralism to Jewish pluralism. Over and above the question of interdenominational differences,
which means Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, or Orthodox, Reform, Liberal, Progressive, Reconstructionist. Over and above, we face a far more resistant and consequential problem that affects all Jews, religious and unreligious, Israeli, English, American, Russian, nationalist, anti-nationalist, liberal, or conservative. Before the emancipation, Jewish life was largely cohesive, organic, comprehensive, and it was held together by the glue of a commitment to Torah, to Judaism. That wholeness was shattered when the ghetto walls were breached by the emancipation and the Enlightenment. Instead, contemporary Jewish life is marked by fragmentation and atomization. That wholeness of Am Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael, Torah Yisrael has unraveled. Except for those whose religious commitment to Judaism has remained strong and vital, the greatest efforts of those Jews who want to remain Jewish but cannot accept the wholeness of the Jewish tradition, their greatest efforts have been directed to fragments of Yiddishkeit. And they include one, some, maybe even all of the following. Zionism, with or without Aliyah, usually without. Israel, in America, the UJA, I think you call it the Israel Appeal here. Jewish philanthropy, belonging to local Jewish community organizations or to overall organizations such as the federations in the United States or your very admirable Board of Deputies. Some say that an expression of Jewish identity is being a liberal in politics. This is part of the Jewish tradition, they say. You gather that I don't necessarily agree. Sociologists in America speak of a new Jewish civic religion as opposed to its official or classical religion. The Jewish civil religion is an amalgam of UJA, Israel bonds, going to Israel. You know, American Jews, I don't know about you English Jews, American Jews no longer tour Israel. They no longer have a trip to Israel. They go either on pilgrimages or missions. Gives it a halo, which is part of the Jewish civic religion. Jewish charity, liberal as opposed to conservative politics, bar mitzvah, seder, Hanukkah gifts, Jewish foods, Jewish jokes, and some residual Jewish Yiddish expressions. Now, with Jewish identity split into so many fibers, into so many fragments, we seem to have little or nothing in common with each other. Moreover, this disunity is exacerbated by the nature of the open democratic societies in which most of the Jews of the world live in today, with the exception of Soviet Russia. Which means that the tendency will be to even make it less united. Our options as individuals are more numerous today than they ever were before in our history. And that all of us must worry, can we as Jews find a common denominator in our mutual ethnic origin? And if we can, will it suffice for our people? Will these centrifugal forces pulling us apart continue to pull us apart from each other? Israel from diaspora, religious from secular, Zionists from non-Zionists, liberals from conservatives, right from left, especially at this time when it seems that advocates of each position are becoming more outspoken, more radicalized, more passionate, and less tolerant of others. It seems that here, at least, pluralism offers the only way out. The least common denominator will hold us together. I accept that. Only a functioning communal pluralism, with a right for all expressions and mutual respect, can keep us working together for the common Jewish weal. But the nagging question is this an ultimate resolution? Is this really the way Jewish history will unfold and develop? That we will have nothing in common than what really means our immediate self-interest? No overarching vision? No nobler mission? No more sublime purpose? Let me recast that question in theological terms and perhaps make it sharper. I promised my wife that when I finish tonight, I will have 50% exactly blaming me for one set of opinions and the other 50% criticizing me for the other set.
In theological terms, are these isolated fragments of Jewish commitment, Zionism, philanthropy, Yiddish, Hebrew, what you will, are they forms of avodah zarah, of idolatry, in the sense that they substitute the part for the whole, which is really a definition of idolatry, that they absolutize the contingent or the relative, that they displace God from the center of our values, our commitments, our lives? Now, whether or not we formulate the question in biblical, theological, or cultural, secular terms, the fundamental question is the authenticity and the viability of the emerging pluralism of Jewish life and community. Now, permit me to put the problem in a biblical perspective. In the Torah, we are told of three britot, three covenants between God and three partners. The first one is the universal covenant of God and mankind. It is the Bris Noach, the covenant that was offered and accepted after the flood. This speaks of humanity at large. The second covenant is the Bris Avraham, the covenant with Abraham, at which time we were formed as a people, and Abraham was promised by terms of this covenant two things, Zera and Eretz, Jewish posterity and the Jewish land. The third covenant we read about in our synagogue day before yesterday, and that is the Bris Moshe, the covenant with Moses. This is the covenant which placed upon Jews not only a cohesiveness expressed by continuity, ethnic continuity and nationalism and a land, but the covenant of Torah and mitzvahs, of religious duties and the Torah. I have a feeling that the charming, beautiful greeting we give to the parents of a newborn child, we say, Tizku legadlo, or legadlo, may you be privileged by God to raise a child, the Torah, the chuppah, the masim tovim, these three things reflect the three covenants. Torah reflects the covenant of Moses, Bris Moshe, Torah. Chuppah, marriage and posterity, reflect the Bris Avraham, the Abrahamic covenant. And Ma'asim Tovim, not mitzvahs, but Ma'asim Tovim, good deeds, being a good human being, reflects the Bris Noach. Now, the Bris Moshe does not deny the other previous covenants. On the contrary, it includes them, which means you cannot be a religious Jew without being a Jew and without being a mensch. Similarly, Bris Avraham, or Jewishness, necessarily includes the universal covenant of Noah, the Bris Noah. Therefore, a Jew who accepts only the Bris Noah, which means that he is a great humanitarian, but knows nothing of his people or his tradition, is effectively and functionally non-Jewish, espousing humanistic values such as peace, nuclear disarmament, the abolition of hunger, the protection of the environment, is noble, but it's not enough to qualify as Jewish. Jewishness includes the Bris Noach, but must go beyond it to embrace an ethnic national identification, the Bris Avraham. But I'm not going to elaborate, because for this audience there is no need to expatiate on the necessity for Jewishness or the Bris Avraham. If you didn't believe in it, you wouldn't be here today. And if anyone, however, has any residual doubts that Bris Avraham is alive and well, and that our Jewishness is our distinguishing mark and the source of our cohesiveness and identification willy-nilly, consider how unproblematic that is for the Goyim. I'll tell you a story that happened in your territory. In July of 1976, my wife and I were aboard the QE2. As a matter of fact, I was on the way to England for a speaking engagement. Now, as you know, the Cunard Line QE2 at that time had what was known as a kosher kitchen. I have no way of knowing whether it is kosher or not kosher. That's not my business. But it was presided over by a delightful person by the name of Mendel the waiter. Mendel the kosher waiter. So many of you may know him from your tree of their philo-Semitism, but they're civilized
even if they are not philo-Semites. The ship's crew, from the captain down, decided there had to be some way to express their admiration for Israel. So the captain lined them all up and marched them down past Mendel the waiter and congratulated him on Entebbe. It means something. To me, it was a great symbol. It means, no matter whether you want to be known as Jewish or not, the Goyim know that you're a Jew, they will congratulate you on Entebbe, and they will criticize you about almost everything else. The salient fact of the Jewish history of our times, it is unthinkable without it. Israel Appeal, the UJA, the most monumental tribute to Jewish generosity. Federations in America, your Board of Deputies, noble expressions of Jewish cohesiveness and community consciousness. That goes without saying. The great question is that enough? Now, if I had to seek a metaphor for the relationship of Jewishness and Judaism, for Bris Avraham and Bris Moshe, I would say buddy and
the salient fact of the Jewish history of our times, it is unthinkable without it. Israel Appeal, the UJA, the most monumental tribute to Jewish generosity. Federations in America, your Board of Deputies, noble expressions of Jewish cohesiveness and community consciousness. That goes without saying. The great question is that enough? Now, if I had to seek a metaphor for the relationship of Jewishness and Judaism, for Bris Avraham and Bris Moshe, I would say body and soul. Take both together, and you have a living, active, functioning human being. Remove Jewishness, the ethnic, national element, as early Reform did when they conceived of themselves as Germans of Mosaic persuasion, and you are left with relative abstractions. You are left with a spirit without a body. And what is a spirit without a body? A ghost. But if Judaism without Jewishness is a ghost, then Jewishness without Judaism is a body without spirit. And what is a body without spirit? A corpse. And dress up a corpse however you will, it remains cold, lifeless, a spiritless relic.
Jewish statehood without Jewish spirit, Jewish philanthropy without Jewish Torah, communal agencies without Shabbat, Jewish, and we have plenty of them in the States, Jewish homes without Jewish books. Well, gefilte fish without faith, and matzah balls without mitzvahs and amunah, and Yiddish without Yiddishkeit, etc., 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 will ensure the survival of neither Jewishness nor Judaism. Jewish life is not and should not be monochromatic and monolithic. In this, Jewish communal pluralism is completely correct. The fabric, the tapestry of Jewish life, is made up of many strands. Yes, of Yiddish and Hebrew, though they were so opposed to each other once, of Zionism and Russian Jewry activism and philanthropy and Jewish academic scholarship, and all of them should be encouraged. But without Torah, they will fail and they will unravel. Pluralism may keep us from savaging each other. They may keep us from each other's throats. Pluralism will keep us from each other's throats, but it will not keep us from being devoured by history, pushed into the yawning abyss of obscurity and irrelevance in the long night of endless centuries. Ethnicity alone, in any of its various guises, Jewishness without Judaism, the body of Jewish relatedness without the neshama of Israel, will keep us going for a while, but not forever, and it will not save us. One of the most poignant, powerful parables in modern Hebrew literature about the failure of Jewish nationalism without Jewish faith, of basically Zionism without Torah, of this Abraham without this Moshe, is the striking image of Yitzchak in Adnon's Shmuel Shoshan. Yitzchak is a poor ole from Europe, and this takes place during the early parts of the first Aliyah, of the second Aliyah, and he stands at the shore of Jaffa before Tel Aviv was built. And he falls asleep on the beach, and Yitzchak has a nightmare, and this is the nightmare. The nightmare is that he is standing on the shore barefoot, no shoes. Then a wind comes from the sea and blows off his hat. At that moment he hears davening, the sound of prayer, in a nearby shul, which is on the second floor, and which cannot be reached except through a ladder. Yitzchak climbs up the ladder, and there's no door, only a window. He opens the window and attempts to get into the shul, whereupon the window slams shut, and Yitzchak finds himself bareheaded in the shul and barefoot without. And he wakes up screaming. Yitzchak's nightmare, that when the hat has blown off, you know the symbol, then in the shul, in the context of Jewish tradition, you are bareheaded. And outside the shul, you're unshod. You can't even have shoes, and you fail both in that world and in this world. You fail in physical terms and in spiritual terms. The problem with relying on Jewish communal pluralism as an ultimate solution is that it simply will not work in the long haul. While it is a necessary modus operandi, it is not the ultimate modus vivendi. Yes, I repeat again and again, we must all work together as best we can, but without illusion. Without the illusion that the least common denominator can substitute for transcendent goals, for prophetic vision. But if Abraham alone, ethnicity alone, is only a stopgap measure, it will not last. It's too thin and anemic a diet. It remains unfulfilling for a questing mind and heart. Jewishness without learning, without duties, without faith, can never satisfy the spiritual longings of young and intelligent people who are searching for something deep and meaningful. Even youth attracted to the Jewish community in its breathlessness, in its round of protest meetings, as we have it in the States, I assume you may have it here, for a variety of Jewish causes, whether Israel or Russian Jewry, is commendable. Certainly far better than the adult who consider themselves too delicate and dignified and their taste too fastidious to engage in such matters as protesting for the rights of Jews elsewhere. But life ultimately demands, something deeper, something more enduring, something beyond. Let me put it in another way. I believe that man naturally quests for the supernatural. By supernatural, I do not mean miracle-making or the suspension of natural law, some kind of magic and tossing off miracles. I mean quite simply, God, who is above nature because he created it. The opening verse of the Bible, Bereshis bara Elokim et ha-shamayim ve-ha-aretz, in the beginning God created heaven and earth, means that the Jewish God is a supernatural one. He is above nature, having called it into being. And we know intuitively, in our very bones, kolatnosai tomarna, that there is more to existence than we encounter in society, in office, in factory, in the family, and in home. That there's something more to life than the physical and the psychological and the technological, than our petty pains and pleasures. And this knowledge must ultimately be translated out of our unconscious, out of a dim and vague awareness, into the full consciousness of man as a worshiping creature of the Almighty. Several years ago, there appeared a new book, great book, called A Rumor of Angels, by a distinguished sociologist, Peter L. Berger, not a Jew incidentally. In this book, the author pleads for an acknowledgement of the supernatural and purports to find what he calls signals of transcendence, of going beyond nature, in everyday life. Some of the examples he includes are hope, the signal of transcendence is the refusal to acknowledge the finality of death and despair. The universal revulsion that all of us feel intuitively when we confront that which is monstrously evil, such as a powerful and instinctual feeling that creatures such as Eichmann or Ivan the Terrible is now being tried, is outside the community of men. And even a sense of humor, in some ways, is a signal of the transcendence. And I believe that thus, too, the penchant for drugs and for the narcotic and psychedelic experiences, and I'm not referring to the addiction of the poor, who obviously turn to drugs in order to escape the dreariness and the pain of life. I refer to the addiction by the rich, who have painfully discovered that money doesn't answer the great questions of life, whose children are bored to distraction by meaninglessness and purposelessness of our affluent society. They search for something they cannot articulate, and they believe that in drugs they will find a self-transcending experience. Well, these are aberrations which I cannot in good conscience recommend to you. But they are phenomena that manifest deep yearnings in the human soul, which may remain dormant for decades or even centuries, but sooner or later struggle for release. And they say something of great importance to all of us. You know, in the realm of psychology, we know of neurotics and neurosis, whereby certain experiences are too painful, too foreign, and are therefore repressed, only to reappear in disguise as symptoms. Well, similarly in the matter of the spirit, the quest for the supernatural, or what great psychologist Viktor Frankl calls the quest or the search for meaning, is often suppressed because of the tremendous cultural pressures which militate against authentic religious faith in a fundamentally secular society, and is therefore expressed in a spiritually neurotic fashion in various disguises. And just as a perceptive psychologist can read the symptoms of his neurotic patient and trace back the original suppressed experience, so a spiritually sensitive person can interpret the disguise under which emunah, ahavat Hashem, the quest for the supernatural, appear in both healthy and unhealthy fashion. And tell me, is that this neurotically displaced yearning for real meaning, for spirituality, for transcendence, at least a partial explanation of the phenomenal number of young Jews in cults? I'm not speaking of those who are just rebelling against their parents. I'm speaking of those in our communities who simply did not find an answer to their religious and spiritual yearning, and they have decided to pasture in strange fields. Secular Jewish activity alone, the Bris Avraham without the Bris Moshe, cannot answer the ultimate questions of sensitive Jews. If they claim to be ultimate answers, they are idolatrous. If they ignore ultimate answers or ultimate questions, they are irrelevant. And in the end, they are self-defeating. I, for one, and here I come to a profession of faith and optimism, I, for one, cannot bring myself to believe that this will be the fate of Am Yisrael. I cannot believe it because I have implicit faith that the fate of Torah is not obscurity, because I believe that Jewishness itself ultimately inspires Judaism. Because I believe with Maimonides that Sof Yisrael Osin Tshuva, that Israel will return. Because I have a great deal of confidence in the Jew and believe that he will soon wake up to the fact that it is futile, eerie, ridiculous to go about dancing with a painted corpse. Most of us come to God only when our idols lie shattered and the shards of their clay feet puncturing our illusions and goading us to look up beyond the confines of our own creations, past the dazzling display of our arrogant inventions, up to the brooding presence which summons us and awaits us so patiently. So it is, friends, with the idols of contemporary Jewish life. If the current revival of Jewish awareness in all its forms is to prove of lasting value, it must go all the way, making the leap from ethnos to ethos, from rallies to religion, from protest to practice, from Zionism alone or Jewish identity alone to the totality of Jewish experience, from Bris Noach to Bris Abraham to Bris Moshe. Or as the late Rabbi Maimon used to say, from Kultura to Kol Torah. Unless there is such an authentic turn, going beyond pluralism with all its value to us, the new Jewish ethnicity will last only as long as the eternal external dangers persist. It will not survive the improvement in the political, social, and economic conditions of Israeli, American, and Anglo, and world Jews. And as a way of expressing my faith in the future of the wholeness and the holiness of the Jewish people, permit me to read to you two paragraphs from one of my favorite pieces in literature, the Nobel Prize acceptance speech by that great American novelist, the voice of the American South, William Faulkner. I decline to accept the end of man. It is easy enough to say that man is immortal simply because he will endure, that when the last ding-dong of doom has clanged and faded from the last worthless rock hanging tideless in the last red and dying evening, that even then there will still be one more sound, that of his puny, inexhaustible voice still talking. I refuse to accept it, he writes. I believe that man will not merely endure, he will prevail. He is immortal not because he alone among creatures has an inexhaustible voice, but because he has a soul, a spirit capable of compassion and sacrifice and endurance. My dear friends, I say the same thing about Jews. I believe that Jews will not merely survive, they will prevail and they will flourish. That we will lift ourselves up beyond the necessary empirical or pragmatic requirements of Jewish communal pluralism, the Jewish vision, beyond Bris Avraham to Bris Moshe. The Jew is immortal not because he has an inexhaustible voice hawking his wares or his shares or garnering more graduate degrees or devising new inventions, but because he has an neshama, a spirit capable of compassion and sacrifice and endurance and love, because he has the insight into a reality beyond himself as an irrepressible urge to reach out to the God of his fathers, because he has the patience to wait years and even centuries for the promise of the God of Israel to be realized and his own hopes vindicated and his prayers answered. Many years ago, in this city, there lived a saint and a sage by the name of Rav Kook, of blessed memory. And he once told the following story, and with this I conclude. He said that when he was a lad on the steppes of White Russia, in those cold, frozen wastes, the school, the yeshiva, was in the valley, and he and all others lived on the hill. And because of the terrible winter conditions, he discovered that when they came down to cheder, all the children were bruised, their clothes tattered from the falling and the slipping and the sliding. Only one person was always clean, neat, unharmed, and whole. And that was the teacher, the Rebbe. And Rav Kook said, I approached the Rebbe and I said to him, how come that we are so tattered, so marked, and you come down so clean, so neat, so whole? He said to him, son, look at the top of that hill. There's a rope, a guideline, and you have to hold on to that. Weil as men es zugebunden eben, glitscht man es unten. If you're anchored in up above, you will not slip to the glove.
Gentlemen, we have been privileged tonight to hear a really special lecture. It's given us a lot to think about. And Dr. Lamb has said that he will answer questions. If any of you would like to put any questions, not statements, please, brief questions relevant to what he's been talking about, you'll be happy to answer. Is there anybody who would like to ask? Okay. There is a microphone by the side.
Dr. Lamb, I enjoyed your lecture enormously, but one thing struck me about halfway through. You were addressing us all from the center of Judaism, from the center of Jewry. What I am wondering about as I look at what is happening to the Jewish people is what is happening on the outside within the non-Jewish world. As we slip and slide, and as we intermarry, and as we try and join the goyim one way or another, or not, is the non-Jewish world, the Christian world, the Muslim world, the non-religious, the anti-religious world, are they going to accept us, or are we possibly going to face the sort of thing that has happened to us so many times before, the Holocaust in Germany, the expulsion from Spain, and so on? I wonder if you have thought of that at all.
Well, I tell you, I'm neither the prophet nor the son of a prophet, as the rabbis used to say. I have no knowledge of the future, or at least not any knowledge of the future that I'm ready to share with anyone. really, my talk was, as you quite correctly say, contained and addressing only Jews. As to whether the goyim will accept us or not,
As to whether they will hurt us or not is two different questions. Whether they will accept us or not doesn't bother me. I really want them to respect us, to love us. That's fairly irrelevant. If they do, fine. If they don't, they don't. If they, whether they're going to hurt us, I think we have to be ever vigilant. That becomes a very serious question. That's one of the reasons to have the state of Israel. The only reason. So I really can't address all the questions, and I have no knowledge of where we're heading into in that respect. Now, you needn't force yourselves, but if you want to schmooze a bit, please feel free. Otherwise, yes, sir.
Like everyone in the hall, I think we've been thrilled by the precise definition of certain areas which are otherwise very dangerous in intercommunal relationships. May I ask our learned speaker for practical help concerning putting over very basic distinction between the validation by the Orthodox of the non-Orthodox and the legitimization of the Orthodox, which is taken by the non-Orthodox from the Orthodox. In other words, when in this country, where the sacred cow is in fact communal unity, a unity as you expressed, where everything is kosher and therefore nothing is kosher, when an Orthodox rabbi will sit with non-Orthodox colleagues on a panel, the element of maritayim immediately is taken.
The element of what?
The element of maritayim. Maritayim.
Ah, yes, yes. Right?
Is immediately taken, sorry, that because circumstantial evidence, because he's sitting there, he is not only validating them by his presence as spiritual leaders, as colleagues, he is also legitimizing the viewpoint which they represent. This cuts across the whole of Anglo-Jewish effort. I and many of my colleagues deliberately, consciously, purposefully cooperate with our reform friends for Israel, for Soviet Jewry, for charity, and repeatedly, time and again, that cooperation is not accepted as a validation of equals in the same struggle and the same campaign. It is accepted as a legitimization of all that they stand for. The question, therefore, put it in one sentence, is, have you any practical advice from the other side of the Atlantic to offer us, Rabbi Dr. Lamb, as to how we can thump home to a community which doesn't appreciate it, this distinction which you so rightly made between the validation of colleagues as spiritual leaders, but not granting them at the same time a legitimization for what they believe in and we cannot?
I was hoping you wouldn't ask that question. I have absolutely no advice to give you insofar as Anglo-Jewry is concerned. I can tell you a great deal of what I would like to see in America. But I'm saying this not only because I want to evade the problem forthrightly, but rather, and it's not really in place for me as a guest, in the presence of rabbis, the chief rabbi, layman, to pontificate, but it's more in place for me simply to lay down general principles and tell you what the situation is in the state. Now, I'm not just being cute about that, because there are differences. Your communal structure here is not the same communal structure in the state. We have strength that you don't have. You have many more strengths that we do not have. There's a tendency to see the grass grow greener on the other side. I think, really, your grass is far greener. But I don't want to go into a discussion of competitive greenness. I'll tell you the policy that I have taken, and I think Rabbi Jacobus will recognize that policy from way back. We have two kinds of mixed organizations in the state. There are boards of rabbis, and there is a synagogue council. The synagogue council is the national body which combines the synagogue organizations, Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, and the rabbinical bodies. Then, separate from that, there is the board of rabbis, which means rabbis meet as individuals, Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, the Constructionists, the whole gamut. In the years that I was in the rabbinate, and again, I'm speaking of the past because I left the rabbinate 10 years ago, I'm luckier than you. I really hope you don't take that seriously. I still miss it. When I was in the rabbinate, the policy that I followed and a number of my colleagues followed was that I did not join the New York Board of Rabbis. I did very vigorously advocate joining the Synagogue Council of America. I continue to do so against even greater pressures than I experienced 2 decades ago. You'll ask me, what is the difference? Because the difference is this. Working only in rabbinic groups, and I'm not saying I necessarily have that opinion for you here. Speaking about America, 10 years ago. The reason for doing that was because when rabbis talk to each other, what do they talk to each other about? It's not halacha. It's not about religion. It's not about internal matters. It's not about rabbinic matters. Well, speaking with rabbis about rabbinic matters as opposed to communal matters might have been misinterpreted not as legitimation. Mind you, not that conservative and reformed rabbis came to me with a begging bowl in their hands and please legitimize me. We're not fooling ourselves. You know, they didn't beg for a legitimation. But I'm not worried about what others think. I'm worried really what is the right thing insofar as my being an Orthodox rabbi is concerned. On the other hand, when we met in a larger group, the issues were Jewish community. What is good for Jews? What is bad for Jews? Not only that, what is good for religious Jews of all persuasions? But because it was with laymen, it had a communal anchorage, had a communal base, and there I felt not only more comfortable, I felt it was, in terms of American experience, much more critical. So I have, again, nothing to offer you in England, but if you're interested in my views in America, that would be the distinction. You see, it's a real problem. Many of my Orthodox colleagues, even many of my Orthodox students, will fear that any kind of contact with a non-Orthodox rabbi automatically confers legitimacy. I don't agree with that. Others, I have others to the left, who are within the Orthodox community, who say, yes, mutual legitimation. I don't agree with that, too. That's why I'm getting shout-outs from both sides. I hope that did not sufficiently answer your question.
Dr. Lam, it was indeed an emotional and intellectual experience to listen to you. Now, could I ask you to address your thinking to the matter, and I put it very briefly, of bridging the gap between Israel and the diaspora. Now, this touches on your own point that you made earlier, whether the grandchildren will still feel an affinity with each other as we do, as our generation does. Now, in Israel, it is said that many of the youth regrettably have stayed so far away from Judaism, they are sometimes described as goyim medevrei evrit. And there was also a movement there some years ago of Kananim, people who believed that they were just of Israel, of that land, and the Jewish diaspora had nothing whatsoever to do with them. And similarly, the counterpart is Jewish youth in the Galut, where one comes across many of them who feel little or no understanding for or sympathy with the Jewish experience, the Jewish faith, with the state of Israel. And it seems to me that this is really one of the most fundamental problems, because it touches on, to coin a phrase, on maintaining both the unity and the continuity of the Jewish people. And I appreciate your comments. Right.
My feeling is that the way to maintain healthy relationship, continuing relationship between Israel and the diaspora, 3 things are required. Number one, Aliyah. I favor Aliyah. When I speak to my students, I tell them, study as much as you can here at Yeshiva. Whether you're going to become accountants or lawyers or medical doctors or psychologists or social workers, plug for Yeshiva University, you could teach all of them. But then go on Aliyah, if you possibly can. I might add that I tell those students who are studying for Jewish education or Rabbanut, if you want to go to Israel, go there when you're preparing for the rabbinate, but don't you dare go on Aliyah. I want them in America,
because they need them in America, and they have to maintain a community which is not Rav Binyan, is Rav Minyan of understanding. So Aliyah is an answer. The means also studying in Israel. Now I'm going to blow my own horn. Yeshiva University has over 1,500 of its alumni who have gone in Aliyah. We celebrated our centennial last July in Jerusalem, and we rented the Jerusalem Theater, and we had well over 1,000 alumni attending. We send to Israel every year for at least a year study from 360 to 370 students, young men and young women. So Aliyah is a kesher, obviously. Number two, what I said before, Brit Abraham, our mutual ethnic origin, is not enough. Because look what happens, we grow apart. And when the Israeli Yored comes to America, if he has no real Jewish background, he's not only a goy medaber Ivrit, he's a goy who doesn't want to know Jews. You don't see them anyplace. So it means simply Jewish education. And third, in addition to Jewish religious education, it means history. One of the big problems is what you pointed out, and that is the what used to be called Canaanism, which has its origins in Ben-Gurion's view that Jewish history begins with Abraham, stopped at the second destruction of the second temple in the year 70 and was resumed in 1948. And that I regard as a terrible, mischievous mistake. Would you permit me just 2 minutes of a story? I've told it to some of my hosts and hostesses here. I feel I have to share it with you. There are two or three people here who were with me in Helsinki in 1969, where there was a meeting of the World Union of Jewish Students of Widges, several miles north of Helsinki, just at the Arctic Circle. And I was there as a lecturer. And it developed, you know, about a 2 or 3 day debate between myself and one Uri Avneri, the editor of Olam Hazeh, a publisher, a very debonair, very bright, very handsome man, who espouses a form of Canaanism, namely, I'll tell you what he said, and I hope you'll get the reference to it. He said, "I am a member of the Hebrew nation. You are a member of the French nation, you are a member of the British nation, you are a member of the Australian nation. We have nothing in common except the remote past, because I, as a Hebrew national, have nothing to say to you who is an English national or an American national." So he went on, Avegahat, Hebrew national, I couldn't take it anymore. Finally, I said, "Mr. Avneri, I'd like you to know that in the country I come from, Hebrew national is the name of a company..." wait, I didn't say it yet. "The name of a company that produces bologna. Except that they claim to be kosher. If we get rid of the baloney, we have a chance of being together."
Well, on that note.
Lamb and baloney.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lamb. And now, just before I call upon Jack Lamb, President of the Naybury First Lodge of England, to give a vote of thanks, I should like to say that Dr. Lamb will be autographing copies of his book, Faith and Doubt, which are down here afterwards. I now have much pleasure in asking Jack Lamb to give a vote of thanks to express how we all feel.
Madam Chairman, Chief Rabbi, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great personal pleasure to propose this vote of thanks. The Naybury First Lodge has been associated with the opening evening of Jewish Book Week since 1947, 40 years, and I'm particularly happy that this lecture should have taken place during my term of office. May I mention that Dr. Lamb gave a keynote address at a very important conference in Israel last summer. It made such an impression on me that I remember thinking at the time how marvelous it would be if he would be able to give a similar address in this country. So when I heard that Dr. Lamb was to give the George Weber Memorial Lecture at Book Week, you can imagine how delighted I was.
I'm sure I'm expressing what you all feel, that we have tonight heard a masterly exposition of the Jew in today's world. It is such a complex and wide-ranging subject, and he has cast new light and given us new perspectives to consider. I was particularly impressed by his unique analysis of Jewish polarization and pluralism, which he dealt with in a unique way. But we all remember his inspiring message of hope for the future, and hope that this will materialize. On behalf of everyone here, I should like to thank you, Dr. Lam, and your wife, most warmly for the great honor you have paid us by coming here this evening. It has been a truly memorable occasion. Thank you.
that.